Jake suggested that Gareth, as a full partner, might like to assist in refitting the engines and painting the bodywork of the cars. And Gareth blanched and lit a cheroot.
Look here, old chap. Don't let's take this equal partner's lark too far. Manual labour isn't really my style at all. I'll have to hire a gang, then. Please don't stint yourself. Hire what you and who you need.
Gareth waved the cheroot magnanimously.
I've got to get down to the docks, grease a few palms and that sort of thing. Then I'm dining at Government House this evening, making the contacts that may be useful to us. You understand?
In a rickshaw, bearing the silver champagne bucket full of Tusker, Gareth appeared at the camp, under the mahogany trees, the following morning, to find half a dozen blacks labouring under Jake's supervision. The colour Jake had chosen was a businesslike battleship grey, and one of the cars had received its first coat. The effect was miraculous. The vehicle had been transformed from a slovenly wreck into a formidable-looking war machine.
By Jove! Gareth enthused. Even I am impressed. The old Ethiops will go wild.
He walked along the line of cars and stopped at the end.
Only three being painted. What about these two?
I explain to you.
There are only three runners. Look, old chap, don't let's be too fussy. Slap paint on all of them, and I'll put them into the package. We aren't selling with a guarantee, what?
Gareth smiled brilliantly and winked at Jake.
By the time the complaints come in, you and I will have moved on, and no forwarding address.
He did not realise that the suggestion was trampling rudely on Jake's craftsman's pride, until he saw the now familiar stiffening of the wide shoulders and the colour coming up Jake's neck. Half an hour later, they were still arguing.
I've got a reputation on three oceans across seven seas that I'm not likely to pass up for a couple of pox-ridden old bangers like these,
shouted Jake. And he kicked the wheel of one of the condemned vehicles.
Nobody's ever going to say that Jake Barton sold a bum.
Gareth had swiftly gained a working knowledge of his man's temper. He knew instinctively that they were on the very brink of physical violence. Quite suddenly, he changed his attitude.
Listen, old chap, there's no point in shouting at each other. I am not shouting,
roared Jake.
No, of course not,
Gareth soothed him.
I see your point entirely, quite right, too. I feel exactly the same way.
Only slightly mollified, Jake opened his mouth to protest further, but before sound passed his lips, Gareth had pressed a long black cheroot between them and lit it.
Now, let's use what brains God gave us, shall we? Tell me why these two won't run, and what we need to make them do so.
15 minutes later, they were sitting under the sun flap of Jake's old tent, drinking iced Tusker, and under Gareth's skillful soothing, the atmosphere was once more a friendly cooperation.
A Smith-Bentley carburetor?
Gareth repeated thoughtfully.
I've tried every possible supplier. The local agent even cabled Cape Town and Nairobi. We have to order one from England. 8 weeks' delivery, if we're lucky.
Look here, old son. I don't mind telling you that this means facing a fate worse than death, but for the good of our mutual venture,
I'll do it.
The governor of Tanganyika had a daughter who was a spinster of 32 years, this despite her father's large fortune and respected title. Gareth glanced sideways at her, and saw all too clearly why this should be. The first adjective which sprang to mind was horsey, but it was not the correct one, Gareth decided. Camely or camel-like would convey a much more accurate description. A besotted camel, he thought, as he intercepted the adoring gaze which she fixed upon him as she sat sideways upon the luxurious leather seats.
Jolly good of you to let me take your pater's bus for a spin, old girl.
And she simpered at the endearment, exposing the huge yellowish teeth under the large nose.
Definitely thinking of buying one myself when I get home. Can't beat the old Benters, what?
Gareth swung the long black limousine off the metalled road, and it plunged forward smoothly over the dusty, rutted track that led northwards along the coast through the palm trees. An Askari policeman recognized the fluttering pennant on the front wing, red and blue and gold, with rampant lion and unicorn, and he pulled himself to foot-stamping attention and flung a flamboyant salute. Gareth touched the brim of his hat to the manner born, then turned to his companion, who had not taken her eyes from his tanned and noble face since they'd left the grounds of Government House.
There's a good view place up ahead. Looks out across the channel. Very beautiful, actually. Thought we'd park there for a while.
She nodded vehemently, unable to trust herself to speak. Gareth was glad of that. She had a squeaky little treble, and he smiled his gratitude. That brilliant, completely irresistible smile. And the girl blushed a mottled purple.
She had good eyes, Gareth tried to convince himself.
That is, if you like camel's eyes. Huge, sorrowful pools with long, matted lashes. He would concentrate on the eyes and try and avoid the teeth. He felt a sudden, small twinge of concern. I hope she doesn't bite in the critical moments. With those choppers, she would inflict a mortal wound. For a moment, he considered abandoning the project. Then he made himself imagine a pile of 1,000 sovereigns, and his courage returned. Gareth braked the Bentley and searched for the turnoff. It was well concealed by underbrush, and he missed it and had to back up. Gently he eased the gleaming limousine down into a small clearing, walled in by fern and scrub and roofed over by the cathedral arches of the palms.
Well, here we are, what?
Gareth pulled on the handbrake, turned to his companion.
Actually, you can see the channel if you twist your neck a bit.
He leaned forward to demonstrate, and with a convulsive leap, the governor's daughter sprang upon him. Gareth's last controlled thought was that he must avoid the teeth. Jake Barton waited until the huge, glistening Bentley began to heave and toss on its suspension like a lifeboat in a gale before he rose from the cover of the ferns and, carpet bag in hand, crept around to the bonnet with its gleaming winged initial B and the stiffly embroidered household pennant. The noise he made in opening and lifting the engine cowling was effectively smothered by the whinnying cries of passion that issued from the car, and Jake glanced through the windscreen and caught one horrifying glimpse of the governor's daughter's white limbs, long and shapeless and knobbly kneed as a camel's, kicking ecstatically on the roof of the cab before he ducked his head into the engine. He worked swiftly, his lips pursed, but the tune stealthily muted, and his brow creased with concentration as the carburetor jumped and heaved, unpredictably, under his hands, and the whinnies of passion and the high-pitched exhortations to greater effort and speed rang louder. The resentment he'd felt at Gareth Swales's refusal to assist in painting the Iron Ladies faded swiftly. He was pushing and pulling his full weight now, and his efforts made even the most grueling manual labour seem insignificant. As Jake lifted the entire carburetor assembly off the engine block and stowed it into the carpet bag, there was one last piercing shriek, and the Bentley came to an abrupt rest, while a ringing silence fell over the palm grove. Jake Barton crept silently away through the undergrowth, leaving his partner stunned and entangled in a mesh of lanky limbs and expensive French underwear.
I want you to believe that in my weakened condition it was a long walk home, and at the same time, I had to try to convince the lady that we were not betrothed.
"Well, get you a citation," Jake promised him, and emerged from the engine housing of the armored car.
With disregard for his own personal safety, Major Gareth Swales held the pass, swarmed the breach, battered down the gates.
"Terribly amusing," growled Gareth. "But just like you, I have a reputation to maintain. It would embarrass me, in certain circles, if this got out, old son. Mum's the word, what?"
"You have my word of honour,"
Jake told him seriously, and stooped over the crank handle. She fired at the first turn, and settled to a steady rhythm, to which Jake listened for a few moments before he grinned.
"Listen to her, the bloody little beauty."
And he turned to Gareth. Wasn't it worth it just to hear that sweet burbling song? Gareth rolled his eyes in agonized memory, and Jake went on, four of them. Four lovely, well-behaved ladies. What more could you ask out of life? Five, said Gareth promptly. And Jake scowled.
We'd put my name on the fifth one, he wheedled. I'd sign a statement to protect your reputation.
But the expression on Jake's face was sufficient answer.
No,
Gareth sighed.
I predict that your sentimental, old-fashioned outlook is going to get us both into a lot of trouble.
We can split up now.
Old son,
actually it would have been dicey peddling a dead'un to those Ethiops.
They've got these dirty great swords, and it's not only your head that they lop off, so I hear.
No, we'll settle for just the four, then. On May the 22nd, the Dunatar Castle anchored in the Dar es Salaam roads and was immediately surrounded by a swarm of barges and lighters. She was the flagship of the Union Castle Line, outward bound from Southampton to Cape Town, Durban, Lorenzo Marques, Dar es Salaam and Djibouti. Two suites and 10 double cabins of the first-class accommodation were taken up by Lij Michael Vasan Sagud and his entourage. The Lij was a scion of the royal house of Ethiopia that traced its line back to King Solomon and the Queen of Sheba. He was a trusted member of the emperor's inner circle and, under his father, the deputy governor of a piece of mountain and desert country in the northern provinces, the size of Scotland and Wales combined. The Ras was returning to his homeland after 6 months of petitioning the foreign ministers of Great Britain and France and lobbying in the halls of the League of Nations in Geneva, trying to gather pledges of support for his country in the face of the gathering storm clouds of fascist Italian aspirations towards an African empire. The Lij was a disillusioned man when he disembarked with four of his senior advisers and made the short journey by lighter to where two hired open tourers awaited his arrival on the wharf. Hire of the motor vehicles had been arranged by Major Gareth Swales, and the drivers had been given their instructions. Now, you leave the talking to me, old chap, Gareth advised Jake, as they waited anxiously in the cavernous and gloomy depths of Number 4 warehouse. This really is my part of the show, you know. You just look stern and do the demonstrating. That'll impress the old Ethiop no end. Gareth was resplendent in a pale blue tropical suit, with a fresh white carnation in the buttonhole and silk shirt. He wore the diagonally striped old-school tie. His hair was brilliantined and carefully brushed, and the sleek lines of the moustache had been trimmed that morning. He ran a judicious eye over his partner and was mildly satisfied. Jake's suit had not been cut in Savile Row, of course, but it was adequate for the occasion, clean and freshly pressed. His shoes had been newly polished, and the usually unruly profusion of curls had been wetted and slicked down neatly. He'd scrubbed all traces of grease from his large bony hands and from under his fingernails. They probably don't even speak English, Gareth gave his opinion. Have to use the old sign language, you know. Wish you'd let me have that dead'un. We could have palmed it off on them. They're bound to be a gullible lot. Throw in a handful of beads and a bag of salt. He was interrupted by the sound of approaching engines. This'll be them now. Don't forget what I told you. The two open tourers pulled up in the bright sunlight beyond the doors and disgorged their passengers. Four of them wore the long flowing white chamas, full-length robes like Roman togas, draped across the shoulder. Under the robes, they wore black gabardine riding breeches and open sandals. They were all of them elderly men. The dense bushes of their hair shot through with strands of grey, and the dark faces wrinkled and lined. In dignified silence, they gathered about the taller, younger figure, clad in a dark Western-style suit, and they moved forward into the cool gloom of the warehouse. Lij Mikhail was well over 6 feet in height, with a slight scholarly stoop to his shoulders. His skin was the colour of dark honey, and his hair and beard were a thick, curly halo about the finely boned face.
with dark, thoughtful eyes and the narrow rose with its Semitic beak. Despite the stoop, he walked with the grace of a swordsman, and his teeth, when he smiled, were glisteningly white against the dark skin. "By Jove," said the Lidge, in the drawling accent that echoed Gareth's with surprising accuracy. "It's Farty Swales, isn't it?" Major Gareth Swales, his composure, seemed to fall away, leaving him tottering mentally at the use of a nickname he'd last heard 20 years before. He'd been so branded when his unexpected attack of flatus had clapped and echoed from the vaulted ceiling and stone walls of College Chapel. He'd hoped never to hear it spoken again, and now its use took him back to that moment when he'd stood in the cold stone chapel and the waves of suppressed laughter had broken over his head like physical blows. The prince laughed now and touched the knot of his necktie. For the first time, Jake realized that the diagonal stripes were identical to those that Gareth Swales wore at his own throat. "Eton, 1915, Wainfleet's. I was captain of the Hearts. I gave you 6 for smoking in the bogs, don't you remember?" "By God," gasped Gareth. "Toffee Sagood, my God! I don't know what to say."
"Try him with the old sign language, then," murmured Jake helpfully.
"Shut up, damn you," hissed Gareth. And then, with a conscious effort, he resurrected the smile that lit the gloomy warehouse like the rising of the sun. "Your Excellency! Toffee, my dear fellow!" He hurried forward, with hand outstretched. "What a great and unexpected pleasure!" They shook hands, laughing, and the solemn dark faces of the elderly advisers lightened with sympathetic merriment. "Let me introduce my partner, Mr. Jake Barton of Texas. Mr. Barton is a brilliant engineer and financier. Jake, this is His Excellency Lige Mikhail Vasan Sagood, Deputy Governor of Shore, and an old and dear friend of mine." The prince's hand was narrow-boned, cool and firm. His gaze was quick and penetrating before he turned back to Gareth. "When were you expelled? Summer of 1915, wasn't it? Caught boffing one of the maids, as I recall." "Good Lord, no!" Gareth was horrified. "Never the hired help." "Actually, it was the housemaster's daughter." "That's right, now, I remember. You were famous. Went out in a blaze of glory. Talk about your feet. Blasted for months. They said you went to France with the Dukes and did jolly well for yourself." Gareth made a deprecating gesture. And Lige Mikhail asked, "Since then, what have you been doing, old chap?" Which was a thoroughly embarrassing question for Gareth. He made a few airy gestures with his cheroot. "Oh, this and that, you know, one thing and another. Business, you understand? Importing, exporting, buying and selling." "Which brings us to the present business, does it not?" the prince asked gently.
"Indeed it does," agreed Gareth, and took the prince's arm. "Now that I realize who is buying, it only increases my pleasure in managing to assemble a package of such high quality."
The wooden crates were stacked neatly along one wall of the warehouse. 14 Vickers machine guns, most of them straight for the factory, hardly a shot through the barrels. They passed slowly down the array of merchandise to where one of the machine guns had been uncrated and set up on its tripod. "As you can see, all first-class stuff." The 5 Ethiopians were all warriors from a long warlike line, and they had the true warrior's love of and delight in the weapons of war. They crowded eagerly around the gun. Gareth winked at Jake and went on. 144 Lee Enfield service rifles still in the grease. Half a dozen of the rifles had been cleaned and laid out on display. The 4 warehouse was an Aladdin's cave for them. The elderly courtiers forgot their dignity and fell upon the weapons like a flock of crows, cackling in Amharic as they fondled the cold, oiled steel. They hoisted up the skirts of their chamois to crouch behind the demonstration machine gun and traversed it happily, making the staccato schoolboy imitations of automatic fire as they mowed down imaginary hordes of their enemies. Even Lige Mikhail,
forsook his Etonian manners and joined in the delighted examination of the hoard, pushing aside an old greybeard of 70 to take his place at the vicar's gun, and triggering off a noisy squabble amongst the others, in which Gareth diplomatically intervened. "I say, Toffy, old chap, this isn't all I have for you. Not by long chalk. I've kept the plums for the last." And Jake helped him to gather up the robed and bearded group of excited old men and herd them gently away from the display of weapons and down the warehouse to the open tourers. The motorcade, headed by Gareth, Jake and the Prince in the leading tourer, came bumping down the dusty track through the mahogany forest and parked in the clearing in front of the candy-striped marquee that had taken the place of Jake's weather-beaten bell tent. The Royal Hotel had undertaken to cater for the occasion, despite Jake's protests at the cost. "Give him a bottle of Tusker each, and open a tin of beans," he insisted. But Gareth had shaken his head sadly. "Just because they're savages doesn't mean that we have to behave like barbarians, old chap. Style. One has to have style. That's what life is all about. Style and timing. Fill them up with Charlie, and then take them for a stroll down the garden path, what?" Now, there were white-robed waiters with red sashes and little red pillbox fezes upon their heads. Under the marquee, long trestle tables were laden with displays of choice food. Decorated sucking pig, heaped salvers of boiled scarlet reef lobster, a smoked salmon, imported apples and peaches from the Cape of Good Hope, and case upon case, bucket upon bucket of champagne. Although Gareth had been swayed by Jake's pleas for economy, sufficiently to order a Veuve Clicquot, not a selected vintage, the Prince and his entourage disembarked to a salvo of champagne corks, and the elderly courtiers crowed with delight. Quite by chance, Gareth had struck upon the Ethiopian's love of feasting and strong sense of hospitality. Little that he could have done would have endeared him more to his guests. "I say, this is very decent of you, my dear Swales," said the Prince, with his innate sense of courtesy. He had not used Gareth's nickname since the first greeting. Gareth was grateful, and when the glasses were filled, he called for the first toast. "His Majesty Negusa Negast, King of Kings, Emperor Haile Selassie, Lion of Judah." And they drained their glasses, which seemed to be the correct form. So Gareth and Jake imitated them. And then they fell upon the food, giving Gareth a chance to whisper to Jake, "Think up some more toasts. We've got to get them filled up." But he needn't have worried, for the Prince came in with, "His Britannic Majesty, George V, King of England and Emperor of India." And no sooner were the glasses filled again than he bowed to Jake and lifted his glass. "The President of the United States of America, Mr. Franklin D. Roosevelt." Not to be outdone, each of the courtiers shouted an unintelligible toast in Amharic, presumably to the Prince and his father and mother and aunts, uncles and nieces, and the glasses were upended. The waiters rushed back and forth to the steady report of champagne corks. "The Governor of the British colony of Tanganyika." Gareth lifted his glass, slurring slightly. "And the governor's daughter," Jake murmured sardonically. This provoked another round of toasts from the robed guests, and then it dawned on Jake and Gareth simultaneously that it was folly to try drinking level with men who'd been bred and reared on the fiery Tej of Ethiopia. "How are you feeling?" muttered Gareth anxiously, squinting slightly to focus. "Beautiful." Jake grinned at him, beatifically. "By God, these fellows know how to pack it away." "Keep pounding them, Farty. You've got to get them on the run." With his empty glass, he indicated the smiling but sober group of courtiers. "I'd be grateful if you'd refrain from using that name, old chap. Distasteful, what? Not in the best of style." Gareth slapped his shoulder with bonhomie and almost missed. A look of concern crossed his face. "How do I sound?" "You sound like I feel. We'd better get out of here before they drink us flat on our backs." "God, there he goes again." Gareth muttered with alarm, as the prince raised his brimming glass and looked about him expectantly.
"Wine with you, my dear Swales," he called, as he caught Gareth's eyes. "Enchanted, I'm sure."
Gareth had no choice but to acknowledge and toss off the contents of his glass before hurrying forward to intercept the waiter who darted in to recharge the prince's empty glass.
"Toffee, old sport. I do want you to see this little surprise I have for you."
He grabbed the prince's drinking arm and prized the glass from his grip.
"Come along, everybody. This way, chaps."
Among the grey-bearded courtiers, there was a decided reluctance to leave the marquee, and Jake had to assist Gareth, both of them spreading their arms and making shooing noises. They finally got them moving down the track through the forest, which emerged 100 yards farther on into an open glade the size of a polo field. A stunned silence fell upon the party as they saw the row of 4 iron ladies gleaming in their new coats of grey, with the heavily jacketed, water-cooled barrels of the vicar's machine guns protruding from the ports and the rakish turrets emblazoned with the tricolour horizontal bars of the Ethiopian national colours, green, yellow and red. Like sleepwalkers, they allowed themselves to be led to the row of chairs under the umbrellas, and without removing their gaze from the war machines, they sank into their seats. Gareth stood in front of them like a schoolmaster, but swaying slightly.
"Gentlemen, we have here one of the most versatile armoured vehicles ever brought into service by any major military power."
While he paused for the prince to translate, he grinned triumphantly at Jake.
"Start him up, old son."
As the first engine burst into life, the elderly courtiers came to their feet and applauded like a crowd at a prize fight.
"£1,500 each,"
whispered Gareth, his eyes sparkling.
"They'll go 1,500.
Lige Mikhail had invited them to dine in his suite aboard the Dunatar Castle, and over Jake's protests, a short-order tailor had run up a passable dinner jacket to fit Jake's tall, rangy frame.
"I look like I'm in fancy dress," he objected.
"You look like a duke," Gareth contradicted. "Gives you a bit of style. Style, Jake, me lad. Always remember, style. If you look like a tramp, people will treat you as one."
Lige Mikhail Sagud wore a magnificently embroidered cloak in gold and scarlet and black, clasped at the throat with a dark red ruby the size of a ripe acorn, tight-fitting velvet breeches, and slippers embroidered with 24-carat gold wire. The dinner had been excellent, and the prince seemed in a mellow mood.
"Now, my dear Swales, the prices for the machine guns and the other armaments were decided months ago, but the armoured cars were never mentioned. Would you like to suggest a reasonable figure?"
"Your Excellency, I had in mind a fair figure before I realised it was you I was dealing with."
Gareth drew deeply on one of the prince's Havana cigars, steeling himself for the wild flying chance he was going to take.
"Now, of course, I'm prepared merely to cover my costs and leave only a modest profit for my partner and myself to share."
The prince showed his appreciation with a gracious gesture. £2,000 each," said Gareth quickly, running the words together to make it sound less shocking. But still Jake almost choked on a mouthful of whiskey soda. The prince nodded thoughtfully.
"I see," he said. "That is probably 5 times the actual value?"
Gareth looked shocked.
"Your Excellency!"
But the prince silenced him with a raised hand. "During the last 6 months, I've spent a great deal of time inspecting and pricing various items of military equipment. My dear Swales, please don't insult us both by protesting." There was a long silence, and the atmosphere in the cabin was taut as guitar strings. Then the prince sighed.
"I could price those weapons, but I could not buy. The great powers of the world have denied me that right, the right to defend my country against the predator."
There was an age of weariness in the dark eyes, and smooth brow furrowed with thought. "My country is landlocked, as you know, gentlemen. We do not have access to the sea. All imports must come through the territories of French and British Somaliland, or Italian Eritrea.
Italy, the predator. Or the French and the British who have placed us under embargo. Lige Mikhail sipped at the drink in his hand and then frowned into the depth of the glass, as though it were a crystal ball and he could read the future there. The great powers are prepared to deliver us to the fascist tyrant, with our sword hand empty and trust behind our back. He sighed again heavily, then looked up at Gareth. His expression changed. Major Swales, you have offered me a collection of worn and obsolete vehicles and weapons, at many times their actual value. I am a desperate man. I must accept your offer and the price you demand. Gareth relaxed slightly and glanced at Jake. I must even accept your condition that payment be made in British sterling. Gareth smiled now. My dear fellow, he began. But again the prince silenced him with a raised hand. In turn, I impose only one condition. It is vital to my acceptance of your offer. You and your partner, Mr. Barton, will be responsible for the delivery of all these weapons into the territory of Ethiopia. Payment will be made only when you hand over the shipment to me or my agent within the borders of His Imperial Majesty, Haile Selassie. Good God, man, exploded Gareth. That involves smuggling them through hundreds of miles of hostile territory. It's ridiculous. Ridiculous, Major Swales? I think not. Your merchandise is of no value to me, or to you in Dar es Salaam. I am your only customer. Nobody else in the entire world would be foolish enough to buy it from you. On the other hand, any attempt that I should make to import it into my homeland would certainly be frustrated, and being watched carefully by agents of all the major powers. I know I should be searched the moment that I land in Djibouti. Lying here, the merchandise has no value. He paused and glanced from Gareth to Jake. Jake rubbed his jaw thoughtfully. I see your point, Excellency. You are a reasonable man, Mr. Barton, said the prince, and then returned his attention to Gareth and repeated his last statement. Lying here, it has no value. In Ethiopia, it is worth 15,000 British sovereigns to you. The choice is yours. Abandon it, or get it into Ethiopia. I am appalled, said Gareth solemnly, as he paced back and forth. I mean, after all, the fellow is an old Etonian. God, I can hardly believe that he would welch on our agreement. It's absolutely frightful. I mean, I trusted him. Jake was sprawled on the couch in Madame Cecile's private room. He cheered his dinner jacket, and perched on his knee there was a plump young lady with a cap of brassy blonde hair. She was dressed in a flimsy daffodil-coloured dress, the skirts of which had pulled up to show bright blue garters around her ripe thighs. Jake was weighing one of her ample breasts in his hand with all the concentration of a housewife choosing tomatoes from a greengrocer's tray. The girl giggled and wriggled provocatively in his lap. "Damn it, Jake, listen to me." "I am listening," said Jake. "The man was positively insulting," protested Gareth, and then seemed for a moment to lose his concentration as Jake's companion unbuttoned the bodice of her wispy dress. "By Jove, Jake, they are rather delicious, what?" And they both regarded the display with interest. "You've got your own," Jake muttered. "You're right," agreed Gareth, and turned to the Juno-esque female who waited patiently for him on the other couch. Her glossy black hair was piled upon her head in an elaborate nest of curls and plaits, and she had large, intense, toffee-coloured eyes and a face whose paleness was emphasised by the vividly painted crimson lips. She pouted at Gareth and draped one arm languidly around his shoulders. "Are you sure neither of them understands English?" Gareth called, as he entered into the practiced embrace of the white arms. "Portuguese, both of them," Jake assured him. "But you better test them." "Very well," Gareth thought a moment. "Girls, I must warn you that we aren't paying for your company, not a penny. This is for love alone. Neither of their expressions changed, and the enfolding movements of sinuous limbs continued without pause. That settles it, Gareth opined. We can talk.
At a time like this?
We've only got until morning to decide what we're going to do. Jake made a muffled remark, and Gareth admonished him. I can't hear a word.
That gullible old Ethiop of yours has us over a barrel, repeated Jake, with sardonic relish.
Before he could reply, vivid lips, pouting and red as ripened fruit, closed over Gareth's. There was silence for a while, until Gareth wrested himself loose and his head popped up, moustache in disarray and stained with lipstick.
Jake, what the hell are we going to do?
And Jake told him, in nautical language, which left no room for misunderstanding, precisely what he was about to do.
I don't mean that. I mean, what are we going to tell old Toffee tomorrow?
Are we going to deliver the goods?
Gareth's companion reached up, took him in a headlock, and drew his mouth down again.
Jake, for God's sake, concentrate on the problem, he pleaded, as he was engulfed. I am.
Jake assured him, rolling his eyes sideways to meet Gareth's, but without interrupting his efforts with the plump blonde.
How the hell do we get 4 armored cars ashore on a hostile coast just for a start? Then how do we run them 200 miles to the Ethiopian border? Gareth lamented, speaking out of the unemployed corner of his mouth.
And then something caught his attention. He pulled free and raised himself on one elbow.
I say, your companion isn't a blonde after all.
Extraordinary.
Jake glanced sideways and grinned.
Yours seems to be Scottish. She's wearing a sparn, by God.
Jake, we've got to make a decision. Do we go or don't we?
Action first, decisions later. Let's engage the targets.
Right. Gareth agreed, realizing the futility of discussion at this moment.
Driver, advance. Gunner, traverse right. Steady. On independent, rapid fire.
Shoot!
Cried Gareth, and the conversation languished. It was half an hour before it was resumed, with the two of them in shirt sleeves, braces dangling and black ties discarded, poring over a large-scale map of the East African coast that Madame Cecile had produced.
There's 1,000 miles of unguarded coastline.
Gareth traced the Great Horn of Africa in the light of the Petromax lamp and then ran his finger inland. And this is marked as semi-desert all the way to the border.
We're not likely to run into a crowd.
There's a hell of a way to make a living, said Jake.
Are we going then?
Gareth looked up.
You know we are.
Yes,
Gareth laughed.
I know we are. 15,000 sovereigns say we have to.